If you're running a business right now, you're playing a game where the rules keep changing. Trade tensions, economic uncertainty, culture wars, the world is rapidly evolving around us. And companies, especially independent and local businesses, are having to adapt faster than ever. That's why Mission Critical is evolving. We're diving deep with the founders, CEOs, and entrepreneurs who are navigating this chaos in real time. The ones making the tough calls, pushing through unpredictability, and proving that resilience isn't just a buzzword, it's a survival skill. How do you scale in an economy that feels like it's on shaky ground? And what happens when policy shifts send shockwaves through Canadian industries? And in a world where diversity, healthcare, and economic resilience are becoming battlegrounds, how do businesses double down instead of backing down? These are the real conversations that matter to business leaders right now. I'm Lance Chung, and this is Mission Critical. Let's get into it. The stakes have never been higher. With Prime Minister Mark Carney calling a snap election for April, Canada is bracing for a fast-paced, high-stakes campaign season. But the big question remains, will young people show up? Voter turnout amongst youth has historically lagged behind older demographics. Trust in institutions is declining, and global politics, from democratic backsliding to the chaos in the US under Trump, has left many disillusioned. Today, there are now more autocracies than democracies in the world, a troubling first in modern history. So in 2025, where does that leave Canada's young voters? Are they engaged, or are they tuning out entirely? To help unpack this, I'm joined by Samantha Rouche, Executive Director of Apathy is Boring, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to engaging young people in democracy. Samantha and her team are in the thick of it right now, mobilizing young voters ahead of our federal election. It's what she calls their Olympics. In today's conversation, we talk about youth voter apathy, the systemic barriers making it harder for young Canadians to engage, and how political parties are or aren't speaking to this generation. We also dive into the global context, how Trump, misinformation, and rise in authoritarianism are shaping young voters' perceptions of democracy. And most importantly, we ask, what will it take to get young Canadians to the polls in April? This election could define a generation. Let's get into it. Hi, Samantha. Welcome to the Mission Critical podcast. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much for having me.
You're in Montreal today. Sunny, blustery Montreal.
It is snowing here today, but things are looking up. It's been warm. So hopefully this is just a bit of a blip.
Yes, yes. Well, I am so excited to be chatting. I only, reached out to you very recently and really appreciate you being able to hop on. I know, we were talking just off camera here, but you're probably extremely busy right now, especially with some of the news that just broke over the weekend and everything. But I really appreciate you being able to chat with us today.
Why? What's going on? I haven't heard the news. Kidding. Yes, we're very busy, but this is sort of like our Olympics, the staff and I were saying this morning. So we are ready to go. We're excited. And we're excited to get more and more young people involved in this election.
Yeah, yeah. So, jumping right off there, you are the executive director of Apathy is Boring, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to engaging young people in democracy. When we say young people, are we saying that just as a general kind of like catch-all phrase, or are you kind of defining it within like a certain parameter of an age range?
Yeah, great question. We typically work with what we call voting age youth. So youth about 18 to 30, 34 during elections. But we do have some things that go a little younger. So one of our program areas is we do democratic reform advocacy. So for example, we'll work with like 16 and 17 year olds who are looking to extend or to access voting rights. Obviously currently 16, 17 year olds can't vote, but many of them want to. So that's like one example, but typically we work with 18 and over.
Okay. Good to know. Important context for this conversation. Yeah. So obviously, we had some big news happen over the weekend with the announcement of Canada's snap election happening in April, which is such a timely thing for us to be talking about or having this conversation. It seems like, young people are voting less, they trust institutions less, and many may not believe democracy is maybe the best system to address their concerns these days. Given all of this, do you think democracy is you know, failing young people, or do you think young people have just become disengaged from democracy as it kind of stands today? What's your perspective on that?
Yeah, I think first of all, I agree with everything you shared. All of those trends have been sadly going on for a number of years now, and it's been the challenge and the work of our organization and so many others to try and address these challenges that keep young people from participating in as high numbers as, let's say, older adults. I think one of the things that we try and sort of unpack for people is that there's a difference between democracy as a system, that being the system where, like, quite simply put, people govern. The power is with the people, the root sort of principles of democracy. And then the actual system that allows for young people to govern, or young people, people in general, citizens to govern. Mm-hmm. Young people on the brain, all people. And so when you look at a country like Canada, for example, we have a parliamentary democracy. Our head of state is, technically speaking, the King of England. There's various, you know, and then the United States is more of a republic model. So there's various sort of systems that can operate. And that's why I like to say it's like the people, the citizens of a country are like the hardware. And our system is like the software that makes it all run. So I think it's important to, especially in times like this, where we're seeing so many countries autocratize, as they say, around the world. Very troubling research coming out. There's actually more democracies in the world today than there are, sorry, autocracies in the world today than democracies. And that's sort of new to this year. So there's various really troubling global trends. And I think that it's important to remember that the system of the people governing is the alternative is autocracy. So we can talk about the system itself, but I'm a democracy advocate, and I do believe that democracy still remains the best system. And I think when you unpack that with most young people, most of them will agree that that's the case. That said, we have a lot of work to do on the operating system of our democracy, and our elected officials, our governments have to do a lot more work, I believe, to engage young people and make sure that they feel a part of that system.
Yeah, that's a good analogy between like the hardware and the software and like kind of the means in which people are able to access their democratic rights, I guess, as a vehicle and just how they're able to get to that point. Every election, you know, we hear that young voters are the future and that parties really want to engage them. But voter turnout amongst young people is still a lot lower than the older demographics. Are parties, you know, why do you think parties are failing to connect with younger people? And I guess like if these political parties really do care about young voters, would we not see a higher voter turnout? Like, what's the disconnect here that's happening?
Great question. Lots to unpack. I think, where do I start? So I think one thing I will maybe just highlight before I get into like sort of the reasons why young people don't participate is that I do actually think that the parties in this election are engaging on issues that are important to youth, which I will say is something I've called out in the past. I do see a lot of messaging, a lot of ads, a lot of, you know, like different sort of content on social media and whatever, where the parties are trying to address some of the critical issues that are important to young people, namely things like affordability, even taxes we find is like a very high priority issue for young people. So I see a lot already, even like what we're like 24 hours into this campaign, in the lead up and in the first day of our campaign, of their campaigns rather, I do see them engaging. So I do want to sort of give them their flowers on that. I think that there's a recognition that millennials and Gen Z really are the largest voting bloc in the country and that they should be engaging on those issues. That hasn't always been the case. That being said, I think because those issues are such high priority and a lot of young people aren't feeling like those, and in fact are correct, that those issues have not improved over the last couple of years. A lot of people are feeling, you know, the impacts of inflation, housing affordability, all those things. And those are very real and material. So I think that as time goes on and those issues don't materially improve, it erodes the trust that people have in the government's ability to address them. So I think there's a real risk if we continue to have these elections go by where people talk about addressing these issues and there's not actually a change that can be felt in a real way. I think that's really what does it. Like, it really is like, well, listen, I voted, I had faith, I got excited, I participated, and it didn't translate into anything real that I can feel on a day-to-day basis. You know, my groceries are still getting more expensive and all that stuff. So I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it is that, like, there are so many motivational barriers that young people face. And so beyond feeling like it doesn't matter which party governs, like, that's a really big one. You know, all politicians are the same. There's no difference between the parties. I don't feel represented. That's sort of like a bucket area. But the other side of it is that they really just feel like, even if they do vote, their vote won't translate into representation. Right. Meaning that if they're not voting, you know, we all know we live in a country that has a first past the post winner take all system. So there's like so many layers to this. But ultimately, people have to feel that it's worth their time and their participation and that they're getting something out of it. And I think for a lot of young people, they just don't feel that they are.
Yeah. And I have to say that just even like kind of the personal conversations that I have with friends at the dinner table or at a bar or wherever it is, there is just this overwhelming sense of being overwhelmed by not only just what's happening in politics, but the world. And it's kind of, you know, I've literally had people, some of my friends just tell me, like, you know, they're just going to either not vote because they don't feel like it's going to actually mean anything, or that they're going to vote for a completely like a person that like it doesn't even align with their values or anything like that, because it's just something different than what's, you know, what has been status quo. And so, yeah, there's just so much going on out there and so many things that are crowding people's heads around this entire process, and it's overwhelming.
100%. Like, yeah. On top of all of the normal information that you have to navigate during an election in 2025, you're also navigating like massive amounts of disinformation, you know, influence campaigns. You know, we got algorithms being run by tech billionaires. Like, there's so much out there, and it can feel like it's like, you know, the fire hose is like literally turned on right into your brain. And like, we are in an age where, especially young people, but I think, you know, people in general are trying to take in and process more information than we ever have in the history of humanity. Like, I don't think anyone would have thought, like, if you look at like the sheer volume that you can consume in an hour of opinions, thoughts, perspectives, and there's so much to learn, and there's so much, if you're curious and you want to learn about what other people are, their lives are like, whatever, you can learn so much. But it also can be extremely overwhelming. It can make you second guess your own principles and values. It can lead you down some weird paths, as we've seen. And so it's very difficult. We also connect less in person than we used to. So there's so many factors to considering, like, or so many pitfalls, I guess, where you can fall off the track of like between leaving your house and getting to the ballot box, that it's like, it makes our work interesting, and dynamic, but it's also very complex, and very individualized.
Yeah. Because I feel like just on its own, being informed about what's going on with politics and government and elections can be overwhelming in and of itself. But then you layer on, you know, tech algorithms, misinformation, you know, things that are just being hit at you from left and right. Like, it's no wonder people are feeling so overwhelmed by everything, because it's just it's just too much, it feels like sometimes. So.
Agreed.
Yeah. So you spent years at Apathy is Boring, really working to increase youth civic engagement. What have you learned about young voters over the years that most people don't realize about, you know, this as a demographic, this group of people?
Well, one, young people are incredibly diverse. Like, there's no monolith. There's no like, oh, this is what the youth vote want, or these. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now we have some really broad challenges that I think are bringing together like interesting coalitions of citizens, never mind youth. External threats have a way of doing that. But I think that one thing that maybe isn't always obvious to people, and I think it's really important to name, is that I've never met a single young person that doesn't care about something. So when we talk about apathy or voter apathy, or it's really a procedural process issue more than it, like, and sort of an ROI in terms of engagement issue, than it is a lack of interest. So I'll give you an example. I grew up in a town outside of Montreal. And I use this example often because I think it's a good one. You know, when I turned 18 and we lived, you know, everyone was like raring to get their driver's licenses, and my friends like got, you know, their first car, and suddenly everyone was an expert in like road infrastructure, the potholes, the like, you know, all of these things. And like, they would have these really detailed conversations about like the road that hadn't been repaired in a few years and why that was and where the budget came from. And, you know, they got really engaged because like, you know, they didn't want to like blow a tire driving home.
Yeah.
And
they were like, living it
literally. And that is a form of civic engagement. So like, how do you tie the guys who worried about their cars with like local government or provincial government or federal government? So I think that's the challenge, is that our civics education isn't always dynamic enough to help people connect the things that they care about with the institutions that have the power to, you know, change or have an influence on those issues. But I think that you'll never find a young person that doesn't care about something. So working from meeting them where they're at and working that way is the best way that we found to get people to care about elections and electoral processes. Our work has changed over the last few years. As I mentioned earlier, like our threats to democracy globally have increased. We're seeing democratic backsliding in places like the US, which is obviously incredibly scary. I don't think I need to like go into why we have like everyone being like elbows up, you know, like we're all very aware of this. But for someone who's been doing this work and who's been focused on trying to make democracy a cause in and of itself, it feels like one of these moments where it's worth emphasizing to people that like, we can't take this system for granted. We can't take our freedoms for granted. We can't take our rights for granted. And that we can also look at participation through a lens of, you know, shoring up, making our democracy more resilient, show it, like getting interested, getting involved is not just a right that we have, but it is a duty. Yeah. And that we have to exercise that as well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So I guess building on that, what would you say are some of the bigger kind of systemic barriers that prevent young people from voting and being informed about the electoral process and everything that's going on?
Well, like I mentioned before, I think there's just so much information out there, and people don't always feel like showing up to vote is going to change the things that they care about. I think that would be sort of the biggest one. Coming out from that, there's questions around like how our electoral system itself could better engage young people. So I mentioned earlier, I think maybe when we were off mic actually, that we've done some work on extending voting rights to 16 and 17 year olds. And there's actually a lot of evidence that extending rights or lowering the voting age to 16 actually improves turnout long term. And one of the reasons is that it's a much more stable period of your life to begin voting. 16, 17, you typically live at home. You're often like just have taken civics courses. In high school, you have access to support, you're living with your parents, all that good stuff. Whereas 18 and over, often, you know, most young Canadians do attend post-secondary. So they're away from home, they might have a different address, not know where they can vote. at that stage of life, there's some of those barriers that aren't quite obvious, but they could be addressed in a really elegant or like elegant way through policy changes.
Would you say that being engaged as a citizen and civically engaged is almost like can be seen as like a habit where the earlier that you start being engaged, that helps you form the habits of just the road ahead and being engaged in politics and elections and voting as you get older?
Yes. Literally research supports this. So if people participate in their first two elections, they're more likely to become lifelong voters. So that's part of the reason why doing something like extending rights to 16 and 17 year olds, having them vote sooner and earlier is more likely. And there's newer research actually that's just came out of Scotland where they extended referendum voting rights to 16 and 17 year olds. And I believe it's the local Scottish elections where they're able to participate. The youth that started voting, as of the Scottish referendum and onwards at a younger age, participate at higher rates in a longitudinal sort of way than their peers who didn't have that opportunity at a younger age. So like we know, like there are solutions there that are workable. Some people are kind of like freaked out by the idea of having younger youth voting, but typically once they start voting, people get over it. They see the young people participating. They're like, oh, you know, actually, which we already know from research, they're very capable of making that type of decision. The types of impulsiveness that we associate with being an adolescent or being a teenager typically applies to situations where they're sort of being reactive. But when they have to actually take in information and consider cognitively, they're ready at that age to make the same types of decisions that older adults do. So there's not really a good reason to keep them from voting. And so that would be one. I mean, I think we all know the conversation around electoral reform as well in terms of like how the ballots are actually counted. I think people resent having to strategically vote. People don't feel like that's, you know, that they're voting for representation. They're voting against an outcome or to sort of manipulate the system a little bit. And it doesn't feel like, you know, you're voting for something positive.
Yeah. That's interesting. I've been seeing a lot of language around the strategic voting in the Ontario election, but also now starting to ramp up around the federal election and, you know, being strategic around voting for the party that usually it's actually in contrast to the party that you just don't want to win and making sure that you're voting to your vote goes towards the best chances against that, right? Which seems like it's counterintuitive to the entire concept of voting.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's true. And I think that the way that we talk about elections doesn't really help. Like, I think even if you're someone who, say, watches the news every night or is like glued to power and politics on CBC or like whatever, and you're really following the coverage, I don't know that we have a great ecosystem in Canada of, really trying to explain what exactly is going on. Like, I think the sort of idea of like horse race coverage of elections is really, really, really alienating for a lot of people. Like most people don't follow sports like it's the NBA or sorry, sports elections like it's the NBA. They're not like, oh, who's winning and whose strategy today and oh, this play and that play. It's like, but often if you're following media and you're not someone who follows or like regularly follows like Canadian current events, if you walk in the middle of election, like there's actually a term for this. There's a media critic in the US who calls it, I think it's journalism of access or something like that. Anyways, the idea is that it's journalists who have access to sort of the different players and are reporting on what they're hearing from some strategist, and everyone's trying to leak bits of information that make their campaign look more favorable. But like, when you're trying to make a decision about who you're going to vote for as just, you know, regular young person, citizen, whatever, who doesn't follow politics as a hobby, basically, yeah. You walk in and you're like, I mean, I don't care what the comm strategy is. I want to know what this policy will mean for me and how it's going to improve my life. And like, it can be much more difficult to find that information, which is why I think that the online ecosystem kind of fills that vacuum. And in there, you can get some really great information. You can have like people who are experts in their fields explaining in like blog posts about how this one policy, you can find that stuff. And you can also find like trolls who are like making content or like, you know, AI generating content that's not even real. And it's like, how do you even begin to discern that? So both ecosystems are not serving citizens, I think, in the best possible way.
Yeah. Yeah. We talked a little bit about how there is kind of like a troubling trend of more autocracies than democracies globally. You know, when you look at the US, places like Hungary as well, like from your perspective, have you seen as a result of this, do you notice that this, or is this something that you've noticed is eroding young people's faith in democracy, or conversely, motivating people to become more engaged to kind of help, avoid that for themselves here in Canada?
Oh, good question. I mean, I think there's two sort of sides to this. Autocracies don't emerge typically. I mean, like typically, obviously there's like military coups. That's like a different story, but like typically in established democracies, let's say the backsliding doesn't happen overnight. It erodes over time. Right. So the most prevalent way for that to happen is through elected autocracy. So like, it'll sort of backslide into like elections are no longer credible, institutions and the courts become eroded or completely lose their power. And over time, power is centralized, usually with a leader or with some like group of leaders. And so ultimately, there's a clear path that like democracies take towards getting to that point. And so people sort of vote for those types of policies. And so I think there's sort of two paths here. One, which is that like, if we don't work to make sure that we uphold some form of social contract, people work hard. You know, I hear this a lot. People who are like, you know, I work really hard. A lot of young people, you know, might work harder than even their parents did, make less money, have less opportunity, less access to, you know, the big important milestones. Like buying a house, but maybe all people are marrying and fewer, all of these things. And so because of all of that, they're like, well, something is wrong with this system. And it's a very human and normal thing when someone comes along and promises you that they are the one solution to all of these problems that you see, and that they will take action and get it done and fix your problems. Like there is a level of like people, it's very normal that people will be like, yes, like I'm, that makes sense to me. And I think that that's, to a large extent, what we saw happen in the United States. There are a lot of people who felt, I'm not saying everyone, there are obviously lots of variations of why people vote for someone like Donald Trump, but like ultimately, there is something there that they think will make their lives better. And so, do I think that that's something that, you know, can galvanize young people? Yes. But I also think that there's a degree of us like, getting our own house together that needs to happen if we're going to advance, you know, that level of thinking where like people need to feel like their basic needs are being met, or that they have opportunities, or, you know, that they're not struggling as much as they are. And so there's two sides of that. And I think it's a real risk to any democracy if they're not able to provide, you know, the people who work, pay taxes and vote, with the opportunities that they expect.
Yeah, yeah. So as we all know, this weekend, Prime Minister Mark Carney just called for a snap election for April. Do you think that, you know, a snap election call helps or hurts youth voter turnout? Like what have there been any historical trends in terms of how that impacts youth voter turnout when an election is called quickly?
I think most people kind of it's kind of a funny thing. It's like snap elections. I feel like if you were following, it was like, okay, there's obviously something's happening here. Like, probably
it's not like a surprise. Yeah.
Not surprise. But I mean, for example, like I think having an election in the spring as opposed to the winter, which we just saw in like the time of year matters, which we just saw in Ontario, obviously, like, not great turnout. We don't know what the youth turnout is in Ontario because they don't publish the numbers. However, like, turnout was pretty low, considering there's so much going on right now. And I think that's really the main thing, is that the context, I think, is making it hard for me to gauge what I actually think. I'm hopeful that it's amazing. I think that in given the context of what we're dealing with, these like threats of annexation, such a weird thing to say, like, I, you know, like, casual, and the trade war that we find ourselves in, I think that is making a lot of people pay attention right now. They're like, the big questions that I think a lot of people are asking is, how are we going to deal with this threat? And who do we want, you know, representing Canada in that discussion? And I think that that is making a lot of people pay attention, because it affects so many different levels of our society. And again, given that we've already had this like sort of long tail of people being very deeply concerned about cost of living and affordability, like, this really directly touches on that. So I do think a lot of people will be paying attention. Being a Quebecer myself, and growing up here, like, I do know a thing or two about high stakes elections. We've often had really high turnout in Quebec when there's, you know, really big ballot questions that feel existential. So, I mean, I'm hopeful that young people show up in really high numbers to have their voices heard. That's obviously what we're working towards. But I also think that this context hopefully does encourage more people to pay attention and get engaged, because it is sort of a unique election for that.
I mean, we're still in the first quarter of the year, just finishing it, and already 2025 has turned out to be a wild year. And a lot of the conversations that are happening through the discourse of politics and the culture of politics has really transcended that into like our everyday lives, about whether we're talking about annexation, like literal annexation, or the price of eggs or whatever it is. Like, it's really, I think for someone, at least anecdotally, what I'm noticing is that for people that are not usually engaged in politics, it's hard to avoid these days.
100%. I mean, like, we're having to respond to these like absolutely disorienting, like, you know, claim, like, false claims about like Canada's, you know, relationship with the United States, like these, and this is an external threat that Canadian electors can't control. But what we can control is, you know, who represents us, as I said, and how they want to proceed and what their vision is for protecting and securing Canada. So those kinds of sort of thoughts are all really intertwined. So whether your primary interest is, you know, business or sport or whatever, it's touching on literally everything. And so I think that's why it's hard to escape, to your point.
Yeah, definitely. So Apathy Is Boring, you know, has been running obviously a lot of election focused campaigns for years. What do you find has worked best in the past against your goals, and how are you applying those same lessons in 2025?
Yeah. So the biggest thing I think that it's important to remember when it comes to like, because the political system can feel very big. It's like Canada's a massive country. It's like, you know, we're making a decision, like Quebecers with, you know, Albertans with people who live in Iqaluit, like all of us are coming together to make this really big decision. But ultimately, it's a lot of very local, it's 343 local elections. That's basically how the Canadian elections are operated. And we're all voting for our local MP. And sort of building on that, the best way that we found to get people interested is for someone to have a face-to-face conversation with them, which is really profound, but also like really logistically intense for an organization like ours. Like, we can't have, you know, people everywhere, you know, all the time having these conversations. So what we tend to do is try and recruit and engage volunteers in their communities, empower them to have conversations with the people in their lives. So a lot of our resources are oriented that way. We'll have volunteer canvassing operations in as many communities as possible. We're signing up volunteers right now. If anyone is interested, you can check out our website. And so we'll be running street teams across the country. That has sort of been our bread and butter for the last 20 years. We know what we're doing there, and we have the skills and the experience to train young people to implement those in really easy ways. We also have an initiative that we call Table Topics, which is about trying to support young people to host their own dinners or their own hangouts with their friends and sort of facilitate an election-focused conversation with them in ways that are not, you know, like overly dry and boring, but actually like fit into people's lives in meaningful ways. And this election, we're also really focused on making sure that people, this has always been a focus of ours, but I think it feels more important, even more important this election, which is to make sure that people get good information from trusted sources. So we'll be sharing a lot of resources from Elections Canada, but also focused on trying to get ahead of any disinformation or malign campaigns that might be going on to misinform voters about where, when, how they can vote, election day information. Like, these are all things that or even things like our electoral safeguards. How are ballots counted? I just mentioned the fact that there's like 343 local elections. Like, who's running those? Who's in charge of the ballots? How does that work? How does Elections Canada make sure that our elections are secure? That kind of thing. Because obviously we've seen in other places how the electoral administration of an election, like the actual, like how the ballots are counted, all that can be really easily weaponized to undermine the results of an election. So we're focused on that as well. And we're actually hosting an ideathon. We've got like over 150 signups so far to try and, crowdsource from youth in our network about how we can better support them with dis and misinformation in the election. And so that'll be taking place on actually tomorrow night, March 25th. And so we'll get more insight hopefully from that to really be responsive to the needs of young people during this election.
Just a few small objectives that you're tackling as an organization right now.
Minor stuff.
Yeah, small things. Yeah. What I love though, you brought it up, one of the unique things about the program that really stuck out to me was the whole Table Topics program, because I do love, and to my point earlier, a lot of my discussions that have involved talking about politics and government and civic engagement have been over food and drink and a dining table or the bar, and you're like breaking bread with people. It's in a non-threatening kind of environment, and you're just a little bit kind of more comfortable to have those discussions. How do you, and so you mentioned that this is kind of like volunteer driven, how do you give people the confidence and the resources to confidently navigate and host those kinds of table talk discussions and making sure that they're relaying, or table topics, I should say, and make sure that they're relaying the correct information and just making sure that they're navigating it in a way that, you know, is correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing is that there's no right or wrong way to do this, right? Like, to your point, like, we so often have conversations over food about a variety of things, especially with people that you know and trust and care about. That relationship is really what makes it easier. So I think if you take a group or a young person or anyone, me, like I can be pretty shy, surprisingly. And so you drop me in a group of people I don't know, I'm going to behave very differently than in, you know, with my closest friends. So I think that's one piece, is like, identify people in your life that maybe you don't have political conversations with that often, but that you would like to. And that's sort of the first step. You know, pick an environment where you're comfortable, and also really reinforcing that it doesn't have to be such a big lift to make a difference in an election. Like, there is research, an abundance of research, that just asking someone to participate can make the difference between whether or not they do. So even that first step of like, hey, I want to talk about this election with you, is really motivating for a lot of people. telling people that I care if you participate or not. I want to know why you might not, what you care about. I want to hear the things that matter to you, like out loud. That alone is really meaningful. So going the extra step of then being like, I don't know, like, let's talk about these issues and I want to know what you think and your voice matters, can shape and sort of reshape a little bit how young people or anyone really views their own participation.
Yeah.
And so that's really the root of it, honestly.
Yeah. Opening the door and just starting the conversation in a safe space, because it can seem a little intimidating for people, especially if they're not used to talking about it, and just get your backs up and kind of like, you know, get like really like tense, and just having, I guess maybe normalizing the conversations around engaging in those kinds of topics and discussions.
Yeah. And maybe, you know, it opens a door towards having more of those conversations and creating that culture and community. The other thing that we do is that when we train the young people who will be hosting these dinners or these hangouts or whatever it is they want it to look like, as you say, it could be just like a pint in a bar, if that's really what you know, it doesn't have to be a huge thing. Is that we try and create a community amongst the hosts as well. So it's like, if you're someone who's like a little bit more, we'll have a Discord channel. We have all these things to try and like get people excited and geared up. Cause maybe it's not the norm for you to talk to your friends about politics, but, or about elections or democracy or any of these things. But like, if you have a little community of support of other people who are doing the same thing, that's new, makes it a little less scary, demystifies it a little bit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And obviously it's important to engage in these conversations outside of an election year as well. So how does Apathy Is Boring work to sustain youth engagement year round or in a non-election kind of year?
Yeah, so a couple of things. Outside of our elections work, we actually do run year-round programming. So we have two main programs that we run. We have our RISE program, which is based in 8 cities. It's a sort of a cohort-based program where we bring together a group of about 12 young people in each of those cities, and they do a 15-week program where we take them through, you know, workshops, skills development, all of that stuff, and they design and implement their own community project with the goal of, like, to the points we were talking about earlier, with the goal of like reducing barriers for young people locally in their community. So that's one. And that runs twice a year for about 15 weeks. We have a spring and sort of a fall cohort. And then we also have our build program, which is a smaller cohort. It's actually a virtual program. Usually we have about 10 to 15 youth at a time, and they learn critical advanced civics knowledge. So it's more focused on advocacy and how they come in with sort of an idea of an issue they'd like to tackle and go through this program to develop their own sort of game plan for how they can advocate to create or change or implement some idea that they have, sort of like a masterclass weekly format. And that also runs about twice a year. And then we also do run table topics actually between elections. So we often have sort of different, slightly changing the format maybe on an annual basis. But I think this past year we ran about 25 table topics outside of the election. And our hope next year is actually to have one in every riding in Canada. So we're extremely ambitious about table topics. But because it's such an easy initiative to sort of replicate locally, and we just want to have young people talking about this across the country. So that's our big goal. It was our election goal as well. 37 days is very ambitious for something of that size. So yeah, we're going to keep it going post-election to keep the conversations happening. But those are the big ones. And then we also do have our Better Democracy campaign, which is growing currently. It's mostly focused on getting young people engaged in democratic reform advocacy. So to the stuff we were talking about earlier, how can we change our democratic software, so to speak, to make it easier and more appealing for young people to participate, but also make our democracy run better and better support the public interest, which to our the other part of the conversation we were having around autocratization, and the idea that democracies are backsliding. How can we in Canada maybe be a model for making our democracy work better for people so that more people believe in it, trust it, are inspired hopefully by it and want to get involved?
Yeah. You beat me to the chase a little bit because I wanted to talk to you about your Better Democracy Roadmap. That outlines kind of some key reforms like, as you mentioned already, lowering the voting age to 16 and replacing the first-past-the-post system. What are some of the key pillars in that roadmap, like those two things, and how do these reforms address young voters' concerns?
Yeah, so you mentioned a few already. We have some around just like voting in elections. I think that that's just over the last, 20 years of apathy is boring. It's just consistently running into similar conversations. At a point, you have thousands of conversations with people who are not sure if they're going to vote or whatever. And you hear a lot of the same themes that come up. So you're like, okay, maybe we can meaningfully address this like for good. And so a lot of those policy ideas are really rooted in that. Democracy is not a cause that, I mean, maybe that's changing. We're very hopeful it is, but democracy itself and our institutions are not always a cause that people get really jazzed up about. It's not like the sexiest of issue areas, but I think is the way that we look at it is it's advocacy that can change the system that creates the issues that other people are advocating on behalf of. So if you're really passionate about climate or you're really passionate about these other things, it's in your interest to understand the system that creates the problems that you're seeking to address. And it's not going to be everyone's issue area, but I do really think it's aligned with a lot of the bigger affordability, housing, all these things that people are really obviously engaged by. So you mentioned voting in elections. That's a big one. We also have a pillar around political finance. So up until the early 2010s, we had public funding of our elections. We had a per vote subsidy. So in an election, depending on the number of votes a party got, you received the party would receive a certain amount of money per year for their budget. Right now, that system is it's not been in place for a number of years now. And we want to bring it back. We want to bring it back and we want to actually lower the donation cap to $100, which is currently the median donation to political parties in Canada is something like $70. Like most Canadians aren't giving the cap. And the people who do give actually receive a tax credit. So we are publicly funding our elections anyways. It's just directed by the people who have the means to donate as opposed to where the votes actually sit, which could be a way to encourage people to, again, we talked about this before, but like vote for the party that they, want to support as opposed to maybe strategic voting. We also have a pillar around transparency and integrity in our politics, which focuses on just making, changing conflict of interest legislation to make it more transparent. Currently, I think this has actually been a really interesting subject of discussion in this campaign already. Yeah. And so reforming that system and making it more clear for citizens, how the system works and then how it could be a little bit more transparent is one area that we're interested in. We're also interested in sort of in the information space, astroturfing and foreign interference. We've had a lot of conversations over the last year about that. One of the things we're looking to do is actually just make it illegal for foreign governments to try and influence our elections through digital campaigns and through funding, surreptitiously influencers or whoever else to try and influence the outcome of an election in Canada. It's not an easy thing to tackle, but it's really important. And then finally, we want to celebrate our democracy. So this is sort of one of our, I think, more simple policy areas, which is just like making the International Day of Democracy a holiday in Canada and giving people the opportunity to talk a little bit more about, our democracy and why it matters.
You're doing the work. It's just listening to all that. I'm like, oh my gosh, it's really inspiring. And also I'm like, oh my gosh, it's a lot of work, but I think that's incredible what you and your organization are doing. So if you could, you know, just as we tail up this combo, as we kind of all get ready for the election in a month, what are kind of the key kind of call to actions that you would love to see young Canadians doing and engaging in ahead of the election, and just to make sure that, you know, hopefully our young voter turnout is higher?
Yeah. I mean, a couple of things that we're doing that I'll spotlight. We have a weekly Politics Digest newsletter called The Feed. I didn't even mention that, which I should have done. So if you want to follow what's going along in a way that's engaging, youth-friendly, simplified, easy to follow with credible news sources, please subscribe. You can find the link on our website. We are also collecting vote pledges. So we have a system where if you sign up and take our vote pledge, we will remind you to vote. We will send you, it's like hitting snooze. We will remind you when advanced polling happens, when election day, we will send you information on your IDs, on everything you need to vote. So sign yourself up, sign your friends up, and we will take care of you. We are also looking for volunteers. So if you want to run a street team, if you want to run a table topics dinner, please check out our website. It's easy to find, apathyisboring.com, and sign up, and we will train you. We will give you all the tools that you need. But we are here to share. You can also follow us on social media. I should mention that as well. We're sharing lots of information there and some fun content. So share our stuff, send it to your friends. Just make it really clear in whatever way feels authentic and normal, whether you're a young person or not, with the people around you that you're going to vote, that you care about voting, that you want them to vote, that their voice matters to you. Again, it can make all the difference. We can do all these fancy things, but at the end of the day, just conversation between two people is really the fundamental building block of democracy. So start there. If you're inclined to do more, come join us. But really just make sure that the people around you know that you care, that they participate. And sometimes that's enough.
I love that. I love that. And I've loved our chat. Thank you so much for this. We'll put all the links that you mentioned in our episode description for anyone to kind of follow up on if they want to learn more, but really, really appreciate all the insight and also like hopefulness that, you know, you and your organization are instilling in kind of an era where sometimes it can feel a little hopeless. So very important, and really, really thankful for that.
Oh, thank you so much. And honestly, it's been lovely. I think that hope and hard work, I guess, are the way forward. And so I myself don't love like this contemptuous kind of like conflicty politics, and maybe that's why I'm drawn also to nonpartisan politics and nonpartisan work. But yeah, if that resonates with your listeners, like please come join us. We're always looking for more volunteers, and we have lots to do, but we're excited. It's going to be a quick rip period, but we're ready. So yeah,
they're ready.
Thank you for having me.
We're ready. Thank you so much.
That's a wrap on this episode of Mission Critical. If today's conversation gave you something to think about, do me a favor. Subscribe, leave a review, and share it with someone who needs to hear it. Big ideas are meant to be shared, and the best insights only matter if they're put into action. Until next time, stay sharp, stay curious, and go make something happen. I'm Lance Chung, and this is Mission Critical.